Welcome to the InternetCases.com podcast. I'm attorney Evan Brown. On November 4th, 2005, Cindy Cohen, the legal director and general counsel for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, addressed a lunchtime meeting of the Internet Law Committee for the Intellectual Property Law Association of Chicago. Ms. Cohen discussed issues relating to the Supreme Court's decision in MGM versus Grokster, as well as efforts by the recording and movie industries to pursue individual users of peer-to-peer software. The talk is being presented here on InternetCases.com in two parts. This first part contains my introductory remarks at the meeting and Ms. Cohen's main presentation. Part two, which will be released at a later time, contains portions of the question and answer session. Here now is the audio from the November 4th meeting.
We're pleased to have with us here today Cindy Cohen, who is general counsel and the legal director for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. As most of you well know, for over 15 years, the EFF has been at the forefront of many high-profile and important cases where technology and the Internet affect civil liberties and other valuable interests. In her San Francisco office, Cindy supervises a staff of 8 attorneys and oversees the organization's overall legal strategy. The topic of today's talk is file sharing, and you may recall that in the Grokster case, the court examined the contours of secondary liability for copyright infringement, holding that the respondents, Grokster, and Streamcast Networks in that case could indeed be responsible for copyright infringement committed by others who downloaded the software that was created by Grokster and Streamcast. Cindy, along with EFF attorney Fred von Lohmann, was among the counsel of record before the Supreme Court in the case representing Streamcast. And in this role, Cindy coordinated the drafting and filing of numerous amicus briefs in support of the respondent's position. And she filled the role, as she cleverly described to me, as the chief amicus wrangler. That was a great description there. Cindy is visiting us here in Chicago from San Francisco, but her background includes some time in the Midwest. She has Midwest background. She did her undergraduate work at the University of Iowa and then graduated from law school at the University of Michigan. Prior to joining EFF, she spent 10 years as a civil litigator handling a wide variety of cases involving issues that back then were even more novel than they are now, including domain name disputes, spam, and government information gathering from ISPs. Her involvement with EFF began when she was asked to serve as the lead attorney in the case of Bernstein versus the Department of Justice, and that case was the first case to hold that computer source code is subject to First Amendment protection. Cindy has testified before Congress and has been featured in the New York Times and the San Francisco Chronicle. She's been quoted in The Economist, The Wall Street Journal, and The LA Times, just to name a few. She's been interviewed on the BBC, NPR, CNN, CBS, and PBS. And now, very much to our enrichment, she can add IPLAC. So it is with great honor that I introduce to you Cindy Cohen.
Thank you, Evan, and thank you for inviting me here today. I'm very pleased. I'm always happy to be back in Chicago. I did a summer, my summer after my first year of law school here at a firm that way back then was called Rudnick and Wolf, and now is somewhere DLA Piper or something or other. But I certainly enjoyed my summer here and all the time since. So I wanted to talk a little bit about start by talking a little bit about the Grokster case, because I think that it's kind of a complicated case at this point, and I think it's raised in some ways more questions than it actually answered by the time the Supreme Court was done. And then I do want to talk a little bit about the lawsuits against end users that are continuing on. I did photocopy and distribute a report that EFF just put out yesterday called RIAA versus the People 2 years later, which is our report on the 2 years of litigation against end users. There are now 15,000 people who have been sued as end users for using peer-to-peer file sharing networks to commit copyright infringement. And that was, as I mentioned to Evan earlier, sometimes you have a moment where big numbers come home to you. And when I realized that more people had been sued than lived in my small town in Iowa growing up, I suddenly realized that we had a pretty big number on our hands. And they continue. There's about 300 people being sued a month now. The Seventh Circuit just earlier this week, I think on Tuesday, heard one of the cases, BMG versus Cecilia Gonzalez, and we'll see a decision out of the Seventh Circuit pretty soon on that. That was a question having to do, case having to do more with a jury. When can you go to a jury on these cases than anything else? So I'm not sure how much relevance it's going to have to the broader thing, but it is something to watch, and obviously here in the Seventh Circuit, something you may want to know about. So let me talk a little bit about Grokster. The issue presented in that case was, when can a technology company be held liable for what its customers do with the technology? It's a fundamentally, I think, important question for anybody who advises a tech company. And I think it's a fundamentally interesting question. We know what happens. We know the responsibility of other creators of other kinds of products when their users use them to commit crime. If you are a person who creates a gun, for instance, we know now from, I think, our U.S. Congress that you have absolute immunity from what your customers do with the product that you put on the marketplace if that product happens to be a gun. If you're General Motors and you make a car and you put it into the stream of commerce, you are pretty much immune from liability from what somebody does with that car. Bank robbers, if you're robbed by somebody using a vehicle, you don't actually get to sue General Motors for contributory liability for your robbery. However, if your tool can be used for copyright infringement, the story is somewhat different. And that was really the central question that was presented in Grokster. And I'm sorry to report that I think that the Supreme Court dodged that question. I don't think that they gave us any clarity whatsoever about when you can be held contributorily or vicariously liable for copyright infringement, which is a tremendously important question. What they did instead was they created a new form of liability called inducement liability, and said, in effect, that they thought that perhaps my clients, could be held liable for that new form of liability. And I think that's particularly troubling. Now, inducement isn't actually really hard. The court announced a pretty simple test for inducement liability, and one that I don't think is actually all that problematic as a matter of analysis or law. It said that one who distributes a device with the object of promoting its use to infringe copyrights, as shown by clear expression or other affirmative steps taken to foster infringement, is liable for the resulting acts of infringement. That's not a very hard test. It's somewhat straightforward in its legal analysis. I think it's actually going to be problematic for small tech companies in practice, because if you look at the contours of what the court said, they are basically saying that that anybody who is concerned about it, whether a technology company intended that the product be used for inducement, is going to have, I think, as a practical matter, the broadest possible discovery I can imagine. You're going to get to look at everything ever said, thought, considered, and every option ever considered for how the product should be developed but maybe not followed. Every discussion about that. I think that the breadth of the discovery burden on a tech company facing an inducement charge is often going to be itself a death sentence for a small tech company. I also worry that under the inducement standard, it's almost impossible to get to win the case on summary judgment. There's almost always going to be a disputed issue of material fact about what you intended for your product. And again, I think that maybe while analytically it's a simple test, as a practical matter, it may end up being a death knell for a lot of companies. Patent lawyers often say that, a patent litigation is the $1 million club. Unless you've got $1 million to defend a patent claim, don't bother. I think that copyright is probably now becoming at least the $5 million club. Unless you've got a war chest of a significant amount of money to pay your lawyers to handle the discovery burden and to take a case all the way through trial, I don't think you're going to be able to roll out your technology. And I think that when the venture capitalists or your other funders realize that this is the hurdle you're going to have to go through, it's going to be extremely difficult to get funding for a product that may have to run in the gauntlet of an inducement claim in order to be brought to market. So I think that while the test itself is not particularly hard as a matter of analysis, as a practical matter, it's going to create a pretty big burden for tech companies. And I think we should stop for a minute and remember what it is, the breadth of technologies that could be affected by this. you know, digital technologies, you know, the things that, one of the things that a computer's really good at is making copies. They do that really easily. They do it as a matter of course. They do it often as a matter of you not even knowing, in caching, in downloading, in the way your computer does things. What that means as a practical matter is that the breadth of technologies that have risk of secondary liability because their end users could use that technology for copyright infringement is extremely broad. It includes instant messaging technologies. It includes CD burners. It includes hard drives. It includes, you know, pretty much every digital technology that has the ability to make copies. And it's pretty hard to come up with a digital technology that doesn't have that ability on some level. So I think that the breadth of this for people who are advising technology innovators is pretty broad. And I think we're seeing that in the advice that's coming out as a result of the inducement decision. But as I said, I don't actually think the inducement part is the worst part of what the Supreme Court did in the Grokster decision. I think that the problem is that they did not give any clarity to either the doctrine of contributory copyright infringement or vicarious copyright infringement. Contributory copyright infringement is, as you know, is if you know, if you have knowledge that someone can use your product to infringe and you materially contribute to that infringement, you can be liable. You can be liable. What happened from that basic doctrine was in a case called Sony versus Universal Music. Back when Sony was on the technology side, they, in the Grokster case, of course, they were on the content industry side of the case. The court announced a rule in the context of video cassette recorders that said that as long as the technology had substantially non-infringing uses, it basically got a free pass from contributory copyright infringement. Now, since that rule was announced, there has been a huge battle between the content industry side and the tech industry side about what Sony means. The tech industry said, as you heard me characterize it, because of course I'm on the tech side of this, that this is a bright line rule, that as long as you can say, as long as you can show that a technology is capable of substantial non-infringing uses, you're home free and you get to go forward with your technology. Hollywood said that it had to be the principal use, that this, the non-infringing use had to be the principal use of the technology. They said a lot of other versions of it, but I think it narrowed down to essentially saying that if the principal use of your technology was infringing, that the Sony doctrine did not apply and you were not off the hook. That was the question that was fundamentally presented in the Grokster case. That's what the Ninth Circus gave us a very clear rule about. They sided with my side of that and said that it was a bright line rule. And unfortunately, the Supreme Court dodged it. The Supreme Court didn't give us any clarity. So the Ninth Circuit's bright line rule is clearly gone now because the Supreme Court has now ruled. And we're back to the fundamental questions we had about what the scope of Sony was before Grokster. And we have no new clarity from the Supreme Court. And I think that's a real loss for us as we try to move forward. I think it leaves a minefield intact that has been problematic for a long time, and now it will just continue to be so. If you look at the two concurring decisions in the Grokster court, I think you can see what happened. There are three judges who signed with Judge Ginsburg, saying, essentially siding with the movie industry, saying that there was no bright-line rule, and three judges that signed on with Justice Breyer saying, basically agreeing with the Ninth Circuit that there should be a bright line rule. And so I think that the court was, you know, I mean, we have three judges, we don't know what they thought, but I think the court was split on that question, and as a result, rather than reach it and make the hard decision, they dodged it. So we don't have any guidance from that. And the second doctrine that was at issue in the Grokster case is vicarious liability. Vicarious liability is a form of liability that's based on respondeat superior way back when, but has since, I think, grown new tentacles and wings and arms in the case of copyright, that says that if you profit from infringement and you have the right and ability to control infringement, then you could have liability. And the fundamental question that has been battled between the tech industry and the content industry in this context is the content industry's position that fair game for deciding whether you have the right and ability to control infringement was whether you could have designed your product differently, such to make it harder for people to infringe. And the tech industry, and we argued very strongly that stepping, you know, putting lawyers into the design room to try to second-guess design decision based upon whether you could use a product to infringe and whether you'd taken every step possible to try to prevent people from making products to infringe basically would be a horrible rule for tech innovation, extremely expensive, and really thwart innovation. And again, the Supreme Court, the Ninth Circuit, took a firm position on this and then sided with us and said, that's right, you don't get to step into the engineering design rooms to try to determine whether somebody has vicarious liability. You take the product as you find it. And you don't get to step back and try to, you know, say, well, you know, if here's this new technology that just came up 10 years after you rolled your product out, and if you actually had put that into your product, you'd help prevent against infringement. So therefore, you're suddenly vicariously liable on day 356 of your product because of some new technology that came out now. Again, the Supreme Court punted. They didn't give us any clarity on this. And indeed, within the inducement standard, they seem to hint that how you could have designed your product is one of the elements that can come into a decision about your intentions and whether you intended the product to be used as infringement. So not only didn't we get any clarity on the vicarious liability prong, inside the inducement prong, I think there's some troubling questions. I think it's important to step back and say, well, why do we care? I mean, technology companies, like any companies, have to deal with a legal landscape. They have to figure out how to deal with lots of legal doctrines, some of which are unsettled. Why should this be any different, and why should we care more about this in the context of copyright infringement? And I submit that there are a couple of reasons why copyright is different. First, I think that that when you look at this, the way copyright is structured, it's structured such that it is a strict liability crime. There is no mens rea in copyright liability, and there is statutory damages. So the entertainment companies don't have to prove damages in any way, shape, or form. They get, simply by virtue of there being copyright infringement and then secondary liability, $750 to $30,000 per work. So think of that in the context of a product like an iPod or a file sharing system or any other system that may allow millions of end users to make millions of copies of something. This is a bet-the-company problem for every single tech company that they deal with. This is not something you can insure against. It's not something you can create a liability protection plan for. It is something that will bet the company. And the second problem with copyright infringement is that there is generally no corporate veil in copyright cases. So it's not only the case that your company is being bet, your house is being bet if you're an executive in one of these companies or principals in one of these companies. And I'm not talking theoretical. The people who created Napster are still in the midst of litigation against them personally for their involvement in Napster. And Judge Patel, who's handling that case, just recently denied summary judgment for the executives of the company, and that case is going to go to trial. So the question of secondary copyright liability facing a tech company or somebody who runs a tech company is not like the other questions that might be facing an executive when they're trying to decide whether to innovate or how to innovate in a particular space. This is bet the company and bet your own house on these questions. So what's the fallout from the Grokster decision? Well, we're still waiting. There have been a handful of cases, I think probably now up to a dozen, where inducement liability has been alleged. There's a couple involving Google that were brought by a kind of softcore porn company called Perfect 10 that I think are some of the earliest ones. The Perfect 10 company is being advised by a law firm out of L.A. called Mitchell, Silverberg, and Knupp, who are some of our opposing counsel in the Grokster case. So there's no question that this is central in their minds. And central to what they're going to argue. So I think those are the cases to watch if you want to see where inducement liability is going to go. I suspect it'll come up all over the place as well, but certainly those are the cases that we're watching. And we'll see. I note that some of my friends at some of the tech firms in San Francisco have been issuing guidance letters to their clients about the Grokster decisions that note the discovery burden. And we're beginning to get anecdotal reports back about chilling effect as a result of the decision, but I think time will tell whether the things that I talk about as being worrisome really end up to be tremendously worrisome or whether there is some way around them. I think it's still too early to tell. But that's the Grokster case. That's my take on it, obviously. I don't claim to be unbiased in this. I was counsel of record for Streamcast and the respondents in this case, and so I'm happy to try to play devil's advocate and tell you the other side's argument, but I do not come here as somebody who's giving you, who's a non-interested observer in that case. I gave too many years of my life to it, but I'm happy to talk about that. I'm also happy to talk about my personal role. I was telling Evan some of the stories about trying to wrangle 27 amicus briefs by over 100 co-signers and some of the interesting stories that came out as a result of that. It was a tremendous effort, and we got a huge amount of support from the tech community. Intel filed a brief on our side of that case. We had most of the major ISPs file a brief on our side in that case. We had a brief filed by Microsoft and Apple that was nominally a neutral brief, but if you read it, I'm absolutely comfortable with everything they said in that brief. And we were very involved in discussions with folks, getting them the facts that they needed in order to prepare the briefs. Obviously, the opinions expressed and the arguments expressed were the amici's own, but there's a lot of work as the principals trying to make sure that everybody has the information they need to write the briefs, and not be wrong on the facts and the procedural history of the case. So the second thing I wanted to talk a little bit was about the suits against the end users, because one of the things that happened as a fallout from the Ninth Circuit Grokster decision was that the entertainment companies said, well, since we can't go after the technology vendors, you leave us no choice but to sue end users. And starting approximately about 2.5 years ago now, they started the process of suing end users of peer-to-peer file sharing systems on grounds of primary copyright infringement. We thought then that as a result of the Grokster decision, when they suddenly got clearance to go ahead against technology vendors, that they didn't have to go after end users anymore and maybe they'd stop. But unfortunately, they didn't. And all their talk about the fact that they were forced to sue end users because of the Grokster decision in the Ninth Circuit turned out to be, I think, somewhat phony. They have now sued, as I mentioned, over 15,000 end users, including a significant amount of people in the Chicago area. There are a couple of lawyers in the Chicago area who are helping people through these lawsuits. If any of you are interested, however, I think we could use more help in that. The cases are primary copyright infringement cases. They're pretty simple. And frankly, the options for most of the people sued are not very good. The reason for that is that essentially, again, if you look back at the copyright law, there is no mens rea. It's a strict liability crime. So the fact that you didn't know that it was infringing, or your child in many instances didn't know it was infringing, is, I think, the entertainment companies would argue, irrelevant to a claim of copyright infringement. And I think they've got a good basis to say that. I'm not sure that every court will go along with them if somebody wanted to challenge it, but certainly as a threshold matter, they've got some support for that position. Statutory damages apply, which mean, again, that they don't have to prove damages, and also means that if you or your child has 600 songs, you're looking at a significant amount of money, at minimum $750 per song. And it also, what that normally means, and the entertainment companies are settling these cases. They're using a third party called a settlement center to do these negotiations. And the settlement center is a bunch of retired cops who are debt collectors by day, I think, and using some of the same tactics that debt collectors use in these cases, although they're not subject to the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act statewide because these are not technically debts. And we've heard some troubling stories. We've heard that people in the settlement center are telling people that, this is a criminal statute, which I think is effectively, especially given the people who they're talking to, an attempt to try to use the threat of criminal liability to settle a civil matter, which is unethical in every state that I'm aware of. They also tell people things like, we don't have to show you our proof. You're guilty, just pay. They're telling kids that they should just take out credit cards and pay with the credit cards, which I think is really irresponsible. But people have very, very few chances, and mainly they need folks to hold their hands through this. I think there are legitimate questions about whether the complaints they're filing are sufficient under a 12b6 rule. I think that there are significant questions about their settlement practices. I think there are questions about the amount of investigation and the type of evidence that they're putting forth and whether it's sufficient to actually prove copyright infringement. But in a situation in which most people are facing a downside risk of hundreds of thousands of dollars and have a settlement offer on the table from between $3,000 and $4,000, those are things that people just can't afford to litigate. But nonetheless, we do need help with these, and certainly I would welcome any creative thinking about ways to assist people in this, or at least get people's voices heard in these cases, because some of the stories are tremendously troubling. We have an inordinate number, I guess. One of the things that's been interesting about this lawsuit kind of juggernaut is it's given us a picture on who's using the internet and who's got broadband service that I think is a little different than what most people assume. We have a huge number of single parents who have put a computer in the house and broadband in the house as a way to try to deal with the fact that they're not always around for their kids and keep their kids at home rather than out in the streets. I've heard that story more times than I can count. That's something that I think surprised me. I think that there are people who, I think that when you think about the internet and file sharing users, you kind of think of pimply kids in Berkeley or, kind of nerdy kids somewhere else. But there are 60 million people using file sharing systems, and that's more people than voted for our current sitting president. So they're not all kids, and they're not all nerds. They are, as my colleague Fred von Loben often says, the entertainment companies want to tell you that there are 60 million criminals in America. We like to call them voters. They are a cross-section of America, and they are a significant amount of people. And you see a cross-section. You see people of all colors. You see people with a wide range of financial ability and situations. It really is a tremendous amount. There are the other thing that's interesting about these cases that I think is an avenue of trying to push a little back on the entertainment industry is that they are suing the person who has the internet account, regardless of who's doing the file sharing. And they are representing to the people sued that the person who paid for the internet account is liable for the file sharing, even if you aren't the person who did it. I think that's wrong as a matter of law. But again, it's not an issue that anybody's been able to really fight them on because of the disparities and the downside risk here. In one case that's being handled in Michigan right now by a lawyer named John Herman, what the company did was they required the deposition of the entire family in response to this argument. So a 7-year-old was deposed, a 12-year-old was deposed, 15-year-olds were deposed in this case, and it turned out that it was a 15-year-old babysitter. They refused to dismiss the case against the family and just added the babysitter in. So, this is the kind of tactics that are going on. These cases are being handled by a firm called Shokardi and Bacon out of Kansas City, who some of you may remember as the company that defended the tobacco companies in those lawsuits for many, many years. The Motion Picture Association of America has recently jumped into the suing end users game. Those cases are being handled by a firm called Loeb & Loeb out of L.A., the Motion Picture Association of America is actually doing something that the RIAA didn't do, which is they're suing people for one movie, two movies, three movies. In a recent case in Racine, Wisconsin, that happened, there was a grandfather who was sued because his grandson downloaded four movies, three of which the family already owned, and they're not dropping the case. They're pursuing it, and they're claiming, $750 at a minimum. I think they actually tried to settle the case for $2,000. And when counsel, this is a Chicago lawyer who's assisting me, so this is a different case, but there was one movie in the case, and when counsel said, well, how come you're settling for $2,000 instead of the $750 statutory minimum? They said, well, it was a real popular movie. I'm not sure that that's an element of copyright law, but that's what's going on in these cases. So they feel a bit like a star chamber to the people who are involved, and I think they're tremendously unfair. Now, obviously, there's copyright infringement going on, and I'm not here to tell you that the entertainment companies don't have a legal right to bring these cases. I think that they probably do in the way that copyright law is written right now. I guess I question whether this is really where we want to go with this battle, and whether this is the right way to try to resolve what is a fundamental dilemma that we have in the digital age, which is how do we deal with copyright in the digital age? Now, EFF thought a lot about that. I mean, we don't just sit here and say, no, 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 you shouldn't do that. We've thought a lot about what the right answer might be. There are a lot of people who've thought about what the right answer might be. We have a particular response that we think is the best way to go, but I don't think we by any means think that we're the only ones who have the right idea. Our suggestion, which is in the very end of this report, is called a voluntary collective licensing scheme. This is how radio works. right? Radio stations pay a set amount of money each month, and then they get to play whatever music they want. They get to share whatever music they want. And that's due to a voluntary collective licensing scheme that they have that's administered by, the central vendors that then pay out to the copyright owners based upon the frequency of the music being played on the radio. We think that effectively, since all of us have now on our desks little radio stations, that we should be able to get the same deal that radio stations get. This will result in a significantly more revenue to the entertainment companies than they're getting by suing 15,000 individual people. And will be a fair way to do it. Now, this is a fee that could be bundled perhaps by your ISP into what you pay. It could be bundled in a piece of technology that you buy, like an iPod. It could be. There's lots of ways you could do it. We think that's the best way to go because it's more flexible than another leading plan, which has been put forward by some Harvard professors called compulsory licensing. Compulsory licensing is how songwriters work. You know, you can cover a song that's been written by a songwriter. You do not have to ask for permission to do a cover. You do have to pay a compulsory amount that's set by Congress, but by the Copyright Office, really. So that it's a compulsory license. They have to license to you. You do not have to go ask for permission, but you do have to pay. And the money then gets distributed back to the songwriters. 20 cents per song per copy, I think, is the amount currently. We think that that's an interesting way to go. I think that having watched Congress attempt to deal with compulsory licensing schemes and the Copyright Office trying to deal with compulsory licensing schemes, they're not flexible enough to deal with emerging digital technologies. We've watched the compulsory licensing scheme for digital radio process that used to be called CARP, I think, that's now got a new name. And those processes really, I think, have been big and cumbersome and unfair and unreasonable. And I think everybody involved with them would agree that it's not particularly a very good model to follow. So that's why we didn't go with compulsory licensing, because of that, our watching of some of the other proceedings that have worked under that. Other people have said that non-commercial file sharing should simply be a fair use or should simply be declared legal by Congress. That's an interesting process. I think there's a merit to looking at things that way, trying to draw a line between commercial pirates, which is why these laws were written. I mean, statutory, Congress didn't sit down and say, well, I think that, Joe in his den should have to pay statutory damages if he downloads music without permission. I mean, these laws were all written aimed at commercial piracy. And I think that the idea of non-commercial infringement being even reached by them wasn't even considered by Congress at the time they wrote those laws because it just wasn't a real factor. And so some people have said, well, why don't we make the law honest that way then? Why don't we carve out commercial piracy from this non-commercial sharing and create different rules for them? This was a proposal that was first floated by Senator Norm Coleman of Minnesota early on but has since been dropped. I think that's a reasonable way to begin to think about things as well. Some people said it should just be a fair use and completely fair. Other people say it should have a different set of regimes and damages. I think all of those are worth considering. So that's kind of my pitch about the end users. And my big thing to talk to you guys, because you are people who are intellectual property lawyers, is to think about whether you can assist some of these people. We have a website called subpoenadefense.org where lawyers sign up if they're interested in assisting people in doing this. It's your option to take cases or not take cases. There's no obligation to do it. Some of these cases are paid cases, maybe at a reduced rate. Some of them are pro bono, and you can decide if you want to, but I think we could certainly use more lawyers helping people through this process. There are resources that we've gathered on issues like parental liability for child file sharing, on bankruptcy and whether a copyright judgment is dischargeable in bankruptcy, and several other things on a web page that we've created called RIAA versus the People that's available on the EFF website. And as we see resources that are interesting and useful to people who are defending these cases, we just try to put them up there, make them available for people. So that's my pitch. I'm happy to answer questions and talk a little more about either the Grokster case or these cases.